From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Islam is the youngest of the world's major religions, and sadly the most misunderstood, especially in the West. A whopping 1.5 billion humans identify as Muslim. Yet there are political forces that have interpreted an extremist version of the religion, and there are racist forces that have deemed them representative of all Muslims. Now, a new biography of the Prophet Muhammad attempts to correct the record on a holy figure that has been maligned by Islamophobes for years. And the author of that biography is Juan Cole. He is the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan. And he's written several books, including The New Arabs, How the Wired and Global Youth of the Middle East is Transforming It, and Engaging the Muslim World. He has a column at truthdig.com, and his blog, Informed Comment, can be found at juancole.com. He joins me now to talk about his latest book, Muhammad, Prophet of Peace, Amid the Clash of Empires. Welcome to the program, Juan.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
What made you want to write a book like this? It reminds me a little bit of the work that Reza Aslan did in writing a biography of Jesus Christ.
That's right. Well, I think both Reza and I want to address the general public with some ideas about how these religions that are so important in our lives started. I've been studying the rise of Islam all my life, and did a graduate work in Islamics at both at the American University in Cairo and at UCLA as a graduate student. And as time has gone on, I've noticed that the bestseller lists at the major book selling operations are dominated by, frankly, bigoted and Islamophobic titles, and that there's just an enormous amount of misinformation out there about the religion.
In your book, you say that Islam is no less than Christianity, a Western religion that initially grew up in the Roman Empire. Moreover, Muhammad saw himself as an ally of the West. That's surprising to hear, I think, especially here in the United States, where we just have not enough education about Islam among non-Muslims. How so is Islam just as much a Western religion as Christianity in its origins?
Well, if you think about it, Christianity began as an offshoot of Judaism, and it so happened that the particular place that Jesus and his disciples were living was Roman-ruled Palestine. So probably Jesus taught in Aramaic, but the New Testament is written in colloquial Greek of the sort used in the Eastern Roman Empire, and many of the concepts that are in early Christianity, come from Greek philosophy. Things like Jesus is said to be the Word, that's the Platonic Logos. Well, I find that Islam is very similar in the sense that it is the Quran is in Arabic, and so it's a Semitic language. It has commonalities with and refers to the Bible, and yet the traditional Muslim sources and also 7th century Christian sources depict Muhammad as somebody who traveled up into the Roman Empire for trade and had quite a lot to do with it. So that was his context.
How much do we know about the man who is known as the Prophet Muhammad? I mean, there's still, in terms of, say, the life of Jesus Christ, this is a figure that is shrouded very far back in history. There's a lot of debate about who he really was, what he really was. Is Prophet Muhammad, the figure who became Prophet Muhammad, a lot newer, and therefore is there more documentation around who he was?
Well, unfortunately, no. That is to say, there's an enormous, voluminous documentation about who he was in the later Muslim sources produced in the Abbasid period after 750, the prophet died in 632, so that's 130 years later, and more. Some of the biographies are written 200 and 300 years after the prophet's death. And the problem is that it seems that in the 130 years or so after the prophet's death, people revered him so much that they tended to avoid writing down very much about him. They did transmit oral stories, but you know, that old game of telephone where you start with a phrase at one end of the room and just have people repeat it. By the time it gets to the other end of the room, sometimes it's not recognizable. Well, I think the early Muslims were engaged in a huge game of telephone. It doesn't mean everything that they transmitted was incorrect, but by the time these things are written down, so much time has passed, and the world is so different that we can't really be sure about very much of it. In my view, the only primary source we have for the prophet's life is the Quran itself, which he recited 610 to 632.
Wow. So today, what we hear, of course, about the Prophet Muhammad, unfortunately, from in the West, a lot of it is misinformation that Islamophobic figures have taken on. And it's unfortunately too easy to insult Muslims because there's a very strict rule about not depicting the Prophet Muhammad in as a figure, as you know, not having a visual depiction of him. And so cartoonists have been able to insult Muslims through a simple drawing and then have politicized it. Can you set the record straight about this whole idea of why it's important to Muslims that Prophet Muhammad not be depicted visually?
Well, I think it's the same impetus as in the Bible, where in the Ten Commandments it says that you shouldn't take graven images. There's a fear that a holy figure like Muhammad, if he's depicted, might come to be worshipped for himself rather than as a human mortal prophet of God. But I have to say that this attitude about the depiction of the Prophet Muhammad visually is relatively new and also not universal. That is to say, in medieval Muslim societies, Mughal India, for instance, there was a strong tradition of religious painting, very much like what you see in the European Renaissance, but around Muslim and biblical themes. And medieval painters, especially in Iran and points east, did depict the Prophet Muhammad quite frequently. Often they depicted him with a veil or a kind of fiery halo that obscured his features, but not even always that. So different Muslims through history have felt differently about this. I think in the Arab world, it has been more common to disallow depictions of the prophet. But I was interviewed a number of times about Muslim protests over depictions, and especially the caricatures, and those are scurrilous, caricatures that had been done of the Prophet Muhammad. And, I don't understand why people don't understand that this is offensive to people. And if you took somebody like Martin Luther King and caricatured him, as Step and Fetch It, there would be trouble about that. So I don't understand why people wouldn't see that caricaturing the Prophet Muhammad would also be poorly received.
Right. I mean, these are insulting caricatures. Now, you cast in your book, the Prophet Muhammad as a prophet of peace. And indeed, the vast majority of the world's Muslims appear driven by that idea of promoting peace. What made him a prophet of peace?
Well, I argue that the Quran is very much about peace, that it is a central theme throughout the book, and in ways that I think popular representations of the religion don't fully catch. But, this book will come as no surprise to most Muslims in this regard. In fact, they're puzzled at how their religion is depicted as bellicose in Western writing. So I did database searches for concepts around peace. The word peace itself in Arabic is salam, which is cognate of the Hebrew shalom. And then there are other words having to do with peace, harmony, conciliation, and so forth. And I traced them chronologically through the book, and I found that, you know, they fall into clusters. So very early in the Quran, there is a concentration on explaining to people how central peace is to the idea of the afterlife, to heaven. The Quranic heaven kind of has levels, and the highest level is peace. When a person is righteous and dies and goes to heaven, they are greeted by angels saying peace. And the inmates of heaven greet each other with peace, and kind of the highest level of peace in paradise, according to the Quran, is when the voice of God reaches the person and says, "Peace be upon you." So, I don't think that these images of heaven and peace are intended to be only descriptive. That is to say, I think the Quran is saying, if this is what heaven looks like, then we should try to implement these principles down on earth as well. That is to say that heaven is a model. And it says that, you know, in heaven, people put away their grudges and there's harmony and so forth. So I think that's, you know, a big theme in the early parts of the Quran, is heaven as a model of peace for down below. Mm-hmm.
Now, Juan, in the Muslim world, if you bring up Jesus Christ, he is considered a prophet, one of the prophets that is considered quite holy, that is revered. And unfortunately, far too many Americans don't realize this confluence between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam that you began to talk about a little bit. So how is Jesus Christ viewed in the Muslim world alongside Muhammad?
Sure. Well, the Muslim tradition and the Quran itself recognizes Jesus as an envoy of God, and John the Baptist as well. And it says in the Gospels, in the New Testament, there is guidance and light. So it speaks very highly of Jesus and his message. There's more verses about Mother Mary in the Quran than there are in the New Testament.
And she really? Is also,
yeah.
Wow.
There are stories about the Mother Mary in the Quran, about the virgin birth, the flight to Egypt is implied, and she has such a high station that some medieval Muslim thinkers considered her a prophet in her own right, because the Quran talks about her receiving divine inspiration.
So on that note, another huge issue that Americans, those among us who are ignorant about Islam have, is that Islam is seen as a sexist religion, that embedded in scripture is a lower status for women. What did you find through your writing about and your researching about the Prophet Muhammad as to the status of women?
Sure. Well, you know, I think all of the great religions were born at times of fairly extreme patriarchy. So you could make that case. But there are things in the Quran that are worth considering in this regard. First of all, the Quran recognizes women's rights to property. And I think it's not widely recognized, but in European law, as it developed in the medieval period, there was a principle called couverture, where once a woman married, all of her property actually was then controlled by her husband. She had no property of her own. This is not true in Islamic law. It was never true. And women always had their own property. In fact, at the time of the beginning of British colonialism in India, when the East India Company was going off to India, some Mughal princesses formed a joint stock company and tried to trade with Britain on their own account. Western women would not have been allowed to form a joint stock company. They wouldn't have controlled it. So I think the most powerful and wealthy women in their own right in much of world history have been Muslim women. And it's only from about 1850 that Western law started changing to allow women to have property. That's one. And the Quran at one point says that God created us as different tribes and ethnicities, and as men and women, different sexes, in order that we might know one another, and then goes on to say that the most pious are the best of them. That is to say, the social hierarchy is such in the Quran that being a true believer, being charitable, and upholding high ethical values are what makes you great. And this verse very explicitly, you know, implies that a pious woman is superior to an impious man. So that seems pretty progressive for the time.
Well, and were there specific things that are attributed to the Prophet himself on the status of women that you might see feminists in the Muslim world today citing?
Sure. Well, that verse that I just gave is an example, and there is a kind of feminist commentary literature on the Quran that is growing up among Muslim women, particularly in the West. Amina Wadud, Johanna Pink, and others are exploring these themes. And I have to say that, you know, after the Prophet's death, after the Quran had been revealed, there are many stories circulated about the Prophet Muhammad that are called hadith, about his sayings and doings and those of his companions. And the more patriarchal parts of the Islamic tradition often are centered in those later oral traditions rather than in the Quran itself.
So finally, Juan, what did you discover from your research around the Prophet Muhammad about some of the other stereotypes that you hear that are cited not as much by American Islamophobes, but also by those today who claim to be Muslim who are extremists, the Islamic State fighters, the Taliban, Saudi Arabia's monarchy, and some of these very fundamentalist sects within Islam about, you know, what awaits you when you go to heaven, or why, you know, this treatment of so-called infidels or women's rights?
Sure. Well, I think that the Islamophobes in the West and the extremists in the Muslim world reinforce one another with some of these themes, and they're very poorly grounded in the Quran itself. So, for instance, the Quran talks about a period in the Prophet's life after he and his followers emigrated from Mecca under pressure to the nearby city of Medina, and the Meccan pagans came after them, fought aggressive war on them, trying to conquer them, take them captive, kill them, or convert them out of their religion. And the Quran instructs the Prophet and his followers to defend themselves, to fight a defensive war against these attacks, which, you know, is a commonplace in late antiquity. St. Augustine, St. Ambrose, the church fathers that formed Christianity after Constantine made Christianity the state religion of the Roman Empire, all upheld defensive warfare. Ambrose said that were you to watch as an innocent were attacked and harmed, you would be as guilty as the attacker. And that's really the sentiment that's in the Quran, that a defensive war is necessary on some occasions. Although, Quran also does say that if the enemy who's attacking sues for peace and wants an armistice, that you should grant it. So you would never do that in an aggressive war, but if you were fighting a defensive engagement, then you'd be very grateful if the enemy wants to stand down. Well, these defensive war verses have been misinterpreted on both by extremists and by Western Islamophobes as somehow aggressive. And if they're read out of context or half of them are quoted, so that's an important point. They're also badly translated in English, I have to say. So The Quran says that you should fight to defend yourself, fight those who fight you. Innocents are not, to be fought, according to the Quran. And then it says, when you fight them, deploy lethal force. You have to, in order to defend yourself. But then try to take captives, take POWs, and then ultimately ransom them or release them on grace. So these verses sometimes are translated as slay them and capture them. How could you capture them if you have already slain them? So it's just badly translated or badly understood.
One, there are Muslims all over the world. What's really interesting about this religion, the newest of the major religions of the world, is how diverse its adherents are. Racially diverse, geographically diverse, the nationality diversity is great. And of course, the United States is home to many, many Muslims of many backgrounds. African Americans, people from Africa, the Middle East, India, Pakistan, Indonesia, you name it. And of course, we have a second generation Muslims growing up in the United States. Do you hope that your book will be read not just by non-Muslim Americans seeking to learn more about this religion that's so maligned and misinterpreted, but also maybe young Muslims in the United States?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, I already have good comments from some of those. It's been one of the great surprises and pleasures of my career as a public intellectual for the last 20 years that one of my constituencies has been young Muslim Americans. As you say, there are about 3.5 million Muslim Americans. The religion has been on U.S. soil for centuries because many Africans who were enslaved were Muslim and were brought here. And we have some writing from them in the 18th and 19th century. And then even before that, there were probably crypto-Muslims among some of the Latinos in the Southwest. So it's not a new phenomenon, but as a matter of millions of people, it's since the 1965 change in the immigration laws. And many of those young people who are Americans and have an American education are eager for an account of the beginnings of their religion, which is historical and respectful, which I try to be. So many of them have told me they're very enthusiastic about this book.
Well, Juan, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you. I'm looking forward to your next book.
Well, thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest is Juan Cole, the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan. He's written several books, including The New Arabs, How the Wired and Global Youth of the Middle East is Transforming It, and Engaging the Muslim World. We've been discussing his latest book. It's called Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. You can find out more about his work at juancole.com. He also writes a weekly column writes a regular column at truthdig.com. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.